Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Just about everybody says they support the Constitution, but the agreement ends there. Which parts of the Constitution, and how are they interpreted? The National American Civil Liberties Union mission statement is, quote, to defend and preserve the individual rights and liberties guaranteed to every person in this country by the Constitution and laws of the United States. That covers a lot of ground. Those who founded the ACLU in 1920 included Helen Keller and future U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. The first cases the organization took to court defended people who had spoken out against World War I, a form of speech designated by Congress as a crime. In World War II, the ACLU opposed unsuccessfully the internment of Japanese Americans for the duration of the war. The organization's 50 state affiliates still take up controversial issues. Caitlin Borgman knows. She's the new director of the ACLU of Montana. Caitlin, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Missoula, and my father was a professor, still is teaching at the University of Montana. He's a philosophy professor. And my mother started her career a little later, but eventually became the director of affirmative action and equal employment opportunity at the University of Montana, and held that position for quite a number of years.
Did their work affect your value system?
I think it most definitely did. It's not so much that they made that explicit to us, but I think that the way they lived their lives, the way they talked about people, the way they treated people, discussed issues, I think that undoubtedly affected my desire to work for social justice.
What does social justice mean to you?
To me, it means that everyone in society is treated fairly, that everyone has a chance to exercise the rights that they are entitled to. Those are the basic things that the American Civil Liberties Union protects, which is why I'm so honored to work for it.
Someone might say, why do the rights need protection? Because they're written into the Constitution.
Rights were actually written into the Constitution because we can't assume that the majority, political majorities, are always going to honor constitutional rights. So it's very important that we have a document that states fundamental rights that no one can be denied the right to exercise, and we need courts to enforce those rights when the political majorities won't do it.
So you're an organization with a limited capacity. We'll talk about the size, et cetera, and your 50 state affiliates. But basically, how do you go about as an organization making decisions about which rights to defend and which rights not to defend with your resources?
I think the ACLU defends fundamental rights such as privacy, autonomy, and dignity, and in particular those that are most under attack. So we have traditionally defended the rights of political minorities, people who take politically controversial positions to speak out. We have defended the right of racial and ethnic minorities in the United States to not be discriminated against, the rights of gays and lesbians to marry, those kinds of rights where the political majorities, as we talked about, are attacking those rights.
I mentioned that you have 50 state affiliates, at least that's my understanding. Can you explain how that works? What's an affiliate of the National ACLU?
An affiliate is an affiliated but independent nonprofit organization. The National ACLU is its own nonprofit organization, but there are several different ties between the National ACLU and its affiliates. There are financial sharing arrangements. So, for example, the ACLU and its state affiliates cooperate on fundraising. And there are also governance ties. For example, every affiliate has a seat on the National ACLU board. So it's a pretty remarkable organization in that sense because it is a very cooperative and well-functioning nationwide organization of independent nonprofits.
Do you have the same mission statement or do you have a different mission statement?
The ACLU of Montana has a very similar but different mission statement.
Why don't you read it to us?
We have a vision statement that says, quote, we envision a world where dignity, freedom, and civil liberties are a reality for each individual. And then we have a mission statement that states, the mission of the ACLU of Montana is to defend, preserve, and advance civil liberties.
I note that your mission statement refers to civil liberties. The national mission statement refers to rights guaranteed by Constitution and law. is there, you're an attorney, is there a significant difference as you see it?
I think for the most part, an existing constitution, both the federal and state constitution, the two are synonymous, but you could imagine a scenario where a right was enshrined into the constitution that the ACLU would not consider a civil liberty. For example, the right to drink alcoholic beverages.
When you refer to the state constitution, do I take it that the ACLU in Montana and other states selects rights to defend in state constitutions as well as the national constitution?
That's right. The federal constitution sets the floor for constitutional rights. In other words, no state can ever infringe a right that is protected under the U.S. Constitution. But states can provide broader constitutional rights under their own constitutions. And as long as those rights don't conflict with federal laws, those rights can be enforced as well. So we often litigate, and the Montana Constitution has special provisions that are actually more protective than the U.S. Constitution. For example, an explicit right to privacy.
Whereas the federal Constitution has an implied right to privacy.
That's right.
Another example of that would be the difference between the Second Amendment of the Constitution, which says something close to a well-regulated militia being necessary for the preservation of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and the Montana Constitution, which makes very clear that there's an individual right to keep and bear arms that does not include the right to carry a concealed weapon. What's the national position of the ACLU on the Second Amendment, if they have one?
I think that's a really good example because the two provisions are very different, so, and could potentially be interpreted in different ways. The national ACLU has traditionally taken the position that the Second Amendment right in the U.S. Constitution is a collective right that was meant to be exercised by the people against a potentially tyrannical federal government. That was in accord with U.S. Supreme Court case law in the past. That changed when the Supreme Court decided District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008, where the Supreme Court explicitly stated that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms, although in that case it was very limited to the right to bear arms to protect oneself in the home.
Yeah, the Heller case held that the right was grounded in the individual's right of self-defense.
That's
right.
Did
not go into the question of defense, organized defense against a tyrannical government. Now, you were saying there's a difference. The Montana Constitution has a very specific individual right. So as the ACLU looks at the ACLU of Montana, the array of choices you have to devote your legal resources, where does the right to keep and bear arms in the Montana Constitution come up on your scale?
We have not weighed in on the issue of the right to bear arms in Montana as an affiliate of the ACLU. And that's consistent with the national ACLU's position of generally not weighing in on this issue, even though it has a policy on it. In Montana, we certainly recognize that the state constitution has a provision that it much more clearly identifies an individual right to bear arms. But the question of whether to prioritize that and weigh in on the issue is obviously a separate one, as you suggest. And to this point, the ACLU of Montana has not found it to be a right that is under attack in the same way that other rights are in Montana. If anything, there is a push by some people in Montana to broaden the right beyond how it's currently phrased. So as you mentioned, it specifically excludes the right to concealed carry, whereas some people want to expand the right to allow people to carry concealed weapons into even such places as schools.
And bars and
exactly.
Banks, which are currently prohibited by either, I believe it is state law.
That's right. And what I think is very interesting about this is that even though we have a long history in the United States, going back to the very beginning of people keeping arms individually, there was always gun regulation, and preventing people from carrying guns into bars was there is a longstanding tradition of having laws like that.
Just as an aside, we interviewed Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law, who wrote a book called A Gunfight. And if any of our listeners are interested in the history of the Second Amendment, it's a very, very thought-provoking analysis. So what are your priorities in Montana in recent years?
In recent years, we've been working very hard on LGBT equality. We've obviously achieved the right to marry nationwide for gays and lesbians, but there are still a lot of discrimination against gays and lesbians that isn't remedied by having the right to marry. It's still possible in Montana for someone to be fired because they're gay, even though they now have a right to marry their partner.
Is that what the local ordinances are about in some cities that have been controversial, anti-discrimination ordinance, which would prohibit that practice?
That's exactly right. To make it clear that gays and lesbians can't be discriminated against in things like employment or being served in places of public accommodation.
So you're involved in those cases?
Yes.
What else?
We've been traditionally very involved in protecting the right to vote, particularly among our Indian population in Montana. And we've brought some historic litigation in that area that we continue to use in recent years to protect Indians' right to vote in Montana.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Caitlin Borgman, the new executive director of the ACLU of Montana. Tell us about the cases specifically.
So the landmark case that the ACLU of Montana brought with the help of the national ACLU was the first case to successfully invoke the Voting Rights Act to protect the rights of Indians to vote.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965?
That's right.
Now, I remember that as a civil rights legislation, African Americans in the middle of the civil rights battles.
That's exactly how it was traditionally thought of. And although the language probably already protected the right of Indians to vote and not just African Americans, it was specifically amended in the 1970s to prohibit the discrimination against language minorities, which was then further specified to include American Indians.
So in what form does discrimination take against Indians?
Some of it is access to the polls, but one big area that we have litigated and which was the subject of this landmark case, which was called Windy Boy versus Bighorn County, is the issue of districting. So depending on how a county sets up its districts, it is possible to suppress the right of the Indian vote, even if it's a significant percentage of the population.
Voting districts.
Yes, okay. Voting districts. So in the Windy Boy litigation, Bighorn County had traditionally elected county positions, including the county commission and the school board, through at-large elections. So there were no districts, and even though Indians were 41% of the population at the time, and this was a case brought in the mid-1980s, no Indian had ever been elected to the county commission.
Let me just say that again as a former county commissioner. Some counties, you have a county, and there are no districts, and everybody's elected at large in the county. In other jurisdictions, the counties are structured into smaller districts. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's exactly right. So what the Voting Rights Act requires is that if you have a language minority or a racial minority that tends to vote as a block, and where white voters also tend to vote as a block, and there's a significant enough minority population, you have to have districts so that the minority population can have representation in government.
Okay, so you brought the litigation. What happened?
So we brought the litigation and succeeded in federal trial court. And as a result, Bighorn County now has districts. And after the litigation, for the first time, an Indian was elected to the county commission.
When was that litigation brought?
It was brought in 1983.
We're 30 years down the road, still a live issue?
It is, unfortunately, still a live issue in certain parts of Montana. So, for example, in 2013, we brought a case against the Wolf Point School Board. That school board actually had districts, but the school board had two districts that were combined into one school board. The district that had a higher Indian population got one seat and had a population of 841, I think. And the district that had a higher white population had a representation proportion of 1 to 140, something like that. And we successfully, we litigated that case and actually ended up settling it, but we used the same sorts of arguments. And as a result, in a school board that previously had representation of one Indian out of eight members of the school board, there is now a representation of three Indian members out of six on the school board.
Raises an issue. You're known for litigation, providing lawyers to people who can't afford them. You're also known when people have a lawyer, you'll file an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, if you think it's relevant. But you will also work in different ways. Is that correct?
That's right. We work through three primary mechanisms or realms, you might say. So one is in the courts, which you mentioned. One is in the legislatures. And then one is in the public. So we do public advocacy and public education on our issues as well.
Working in the legislature and public education imply the potential of membership. Now, you can influence legislation because if you have a threat of a lawsuit behind it, that carries some clout. But do you have members in the national and the local affiliate?
We do. And our local membership is about 1,500, between 1,500 and 2,000 members. We have more people who take action for the ACLU through action alerts and things like that. But people who pay, we consider members to be people who pay an annual membership fee to be a member of the ACLU of Montana. And of those numbers are between 1,500 and 2,000.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Caitlin Borgman, the new executive director of the ACLU of Montana. The ACLU has been involved in controversial litigation revolving around religious freedom and the limits thereof. Can you summarize the ACLU's position on that issue?
Yes, I'm glad you raised that. I think that it's very important to know that the ACLU is not only not anti-religion, but actually strongly defends the right to religious freedom. As you mentioned before, though, rights are not without limitation. And in the area of religious freedom in particular, there can be clashes between people who are trying to exercise a particular religious belief and people who have other rights that conflict with those. A good example of that would be people who are lesbian or gay and are seeking services, either the right to get a marriage certificate or the right to enter a place of public accommodation. And the ACLU's position is that although we ardently defend the rights of people to exercise their religion freely, that does not mean that an individual has the right to impose their religious beliefs on others in a way that would harm that person or deprive them of their own rights, and that you have to balance a person's religious freedom against the needs of society. Laws that are applied generally to everyone and that don't infringe substantially on a person's free exercise rights should be enforced against everyone. And that includes, for example, places of public accommodation. We wouldn't allow today, and we bemoan the time when people barred African Americans from entering into places of public accommodation or seated them
motels.
Separately.
Yeah,
the whites-only laws, the whites-only signs. That's an era that we don't want to go back to with just a different population. And it doesn't matter whether the objection is based on religious rights. Once people enter the public sphere and want to open a secular store that serves people of diverse faiths, that employs people of diverse faiths, they need to abide by public rules.
Okay, let's break that down for a minute. There was recently a case in Kentucky where a county clerk refused to issue a marriage license to a gay couple. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that's a violation of their constitutional right of equal protection, let's say, as balanced against that person's religious view that gay people should not be married. Fair?
That's right. The Supreme Court has now made it clear, and we always took the position, that gays and lesbians have a fundamental right to be married, whether you base that in discrimination or a fundamental constitutional right.
Let me give another example of what I remember. I don't remember the specifics, but I believe it was a Native American tribe used peyote, which is a prohibited narcotic, in their religious ceremonies. They were convicted and imprisoned. What was the ACLU's position on that?
Right. So what happened in that case is that they were denied unemployment benefits because they had had these criminal convictions for the sacramental use of peyote. And that's a great example of a contrasting case where that exercise of being able to exercise a religious ceremony goes to the core of what the free exercise clause means. And it doesn't infringe on other people's constitutional rights to let someone ingest peyote in a sacramental ritual, as Native Americans have for a very long time. So the ACLU took the position in that case that there should not have been a denial of unemployment benefits to those individuals.
Okay, one more quickly. There was a Montana case. You may or may not be familiar with it. A 4-3 vote. We interviewed Justice Wheat about it. The Hutterites, who stay away as a central provision of their religious, from government engagement as a central provision of their religious philosophy, were legislatively required to participate in workmen's comp. They fought it. They lost on a 4-3 vote. The decision was it did not go to a central provision of their religious philosophy. Was the ACLU involved in that, or do you have an opinion on that?
I don't know whether the ACLU was involved, but there have been similar cases about, for example, the desire of groups, religious groups, to not pay Social Security benefits. And generally, the ACLU has taken the position that when an employee has a right to something and the employer is not what we would call a pervasively sectarian entity, like a church, for example, that they need to comply with the general laws.
Okay, let me just see if I heard the last thing. Sectarian institution. Are you saying that churches should be able to hire people, let's say, of their own religion, which is a form of discrimination, but because it is a religious institution, they should have that right? Do I understand that correctly?
Absolutely. So the ACLU would not argue, for example, that the Catholic Church should have to ordain women on the grounds that that's sex discrimination. That goes to the core of the Catholic Church's beliefs and practices.
Let's talk about some of the lobbying that you get involved with in the legislature. Can you give us some examples of what you lobby for?
Yeah, we lobby for criminal justice reform. We have been doing a lot of that recently, for privacy legislation.
What do you mean, privacy legislation?
A particular area of privacy that is currently being threatened is the right to privacy in our digital, what we might call our digital information or digital privacy, which arises because of the digital devices that we use. For example, our smartphones and our computers that have all of this information on them, and then also advances in technology that give the state more tools to get access to that information, potentially violating our privacy rights.
So what do you do about it, and who do you end up working with in the legislature?
We have worked on both sides of the aisle in the legislature to get legislation passed that protects people's privacy rights. For example, in the 2015 legislative session, we supported quite a number of bills, and three bills and one resolution passed with bipartisan support, and the three bills were signed into law by Governor Bullock. So it's definitely an issue that both Republicans and Democrats are concerned about.
The ACLU has been active, as you say, in prison reform. If I remember correctly, it was instrumental in establishing the statewide public defender system in this state, as opposed to a county-by-county defense attorneys. I think they were appointed by judges in the counties. I was somewhat surprised to see the ACLU endorse in Lewis and Clark County a bond measure for a greatly expanded correctional facility. Can you discuss that?
I think it's understandable for some of our supporters to be surprised that we would support a bond that would finance the construction of a detention facility, because one of the ACLU's high priorities has been to reduce the rate of incarceration. And we did have some concerns about the size of the facility in Lewis and Clark County, but what drove us to support the two bonds were the condition of the current jail, which was built to house between 45 and 55 inmates and now houses over 90. So you have inmates sleeping in hallways and in the library, and there are no services for outdoor recreation. There is a real dearth of services to keep people out of jail who shouldn't be in the first place. Perhaps they just need mental health services. And so there were two bonds that needed to both pass in order to take effect. And the first bond was to build the facility, but the second one was to provide for more of these programs for inmates and also diversion programs that would keep people out of jail that shouldn't be there in the first place. And those things drove us to support the two measures because the current situation is intolerable. And I think even if we litigated successfully, we'd ultimately want to see the county building a new facility.
Let's talk about the death penalty. My understanding is both the national organization and the local affiliate oppose the death penalty. Now, the death penalty has never been, to my knowledge, held unconstitutional at a federal level. I don't know if it's been ever held unconstitutional in any state courts. There are states that do not have the death penalty. So since it's not a law or a constitutional right not to be executed, what's the basis for your engagement in the issue?
There are a couple of different constitutional concerns with the death penalty. One argument is that the death penalty simply violates the right against cruel and unusual punishment. And that would be an argument that applies to the death penalty as a whole. Even if a person in general supports the death penalty as appropriate in some cases, there are serious concerns that I think everyone should share about how the death penalty is administered in the United States.
Meaning what?
There are problems in racial disparities with who is more likely to get the death penalty. African Americans, for example, are more likely to get the death penalty or disproportionately likely relative to their population. People who murder African-American suspects are less likely to get the death penalty than those who murder white victims. So that's one problem. Another problem is the cost involved in defending against the death penalty. Our rights shouldn't matter. Our ability to exercise them shouldn't matter shouldn't vary based on how many resources someone has. But if you're poor, it's harder to afford an attorney to defend against a death sentence.
So you're saying there's a money warp in terms of the application of the death penalty.
Exactly. And finally, there is an intolerable risk of executing innocent people that we will never be able to make go away. We know that people have been exonerated from who have been on death row from things like DNA testing who were innocent. And so we know that there is always going to be a risk that innocent people will be executed and surely have been. And it is not tolerable. We can't construct a criminal justice system that is not occasionally going to let that kind of case fall through the cracks so that we end up executing an innocent person. And unless we are willing to tolerate that risk, we can't support the death penalty. And the ACLU certainly doesn't think that's a risk that we can accept.
Caitlin Borgman, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.